Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd.
We're interrupting your programming to tell you about that major hurricane barreling toward the Gulf Coast of the United States, Hurricane Katrina. In the bullseye is New Orleans, and because that city sits low and much of that city is below sea level, that is posing a great threat to that city. The mayor of New Orleans speaking just a short time ago, saying that he is making the unprecedented move of ordering the evacuation of that entire city.
And now, 10 years after the levees failed in Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans is not the city it once was. Official recovery efforts executed by well-paid contractors have failed to fully restore low-income neighborhoods, whose former residents suspect the city didn't really want them back in some cases. Some arguably repairable public housing has been demolished, and rents keep rising as newcomers move in and gentrify the city. Once failing public schools have been replaced by a network of privately run charters whose performance has been challenging to monitor. And yet, as my guest has discovered, there was a lot about New Orleans that Katrina couldn't touch, including the determination of many residents to preserve the spirit of the city despite the physical damage to the places they had called home for generations. The new book by urbanist Roberta Brandes Gratz is called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Roberta, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
You write that you've always been drawn to New Orleans for its urbanism. What makes city living there unique?
Well, it's interesting. This book is my fifth book, and it's I've been writing about how cities thrive, fall apart, get reborn, over 40 years. And I had written a little bit about New Orleans in three of my prior books, so I had had an introduction. But when I came down right after Katrina, 3 weeks later, to do the first story that I wrote, I started wandering the city and discovered a city that I hardly knew. I had written about the French Quarter. I had written about the Garden District. I had written about the highway, the Robert Moses proposed highway that would have ruined the French Quarter and was fortunately defeated. But I discovered a city that I hardly understood was as urban as I have discovered. New Orleans has an urbanism that most American cities had to a certain extent, not in the terms of the architecture, because that always varies from city to city, but certainly in terms of it having a tightly woven grid of streets, not interrupted by highways and collector roads, streets that go two-way, some go one-way, some are boulevards. But what it does is lend itself to the classic urban geography that allowed neighborhoods to have corner stores, which New Orleans still has. It has small businesses nestled into residential neighborhoods. It has genuine mixed uses, not the kind of mixed use defined by developers in a tall project where you have retail, business, commercial, and residential, but real mixtures. You might have a library in the middle of a residential neighborhood, or a small factory, or a corner bar, or a coffee house. So this turned into something I didn't realize existed, because I've seen so many American cities that once had this kind of real comfortable urban mix had been wiped out for so many urban renewal, highway, and public housing projects, that it is a fabric, an urban fabric, that is not left in many cities. So I just fell in love with being here. What was interesting to me as well is, while you have an impression looking at the architecture, which of course is splendid, and so much of it that for all sorts of reasons has survived, but a lot of what you think are single-family homes are often two- and three-family homes. So there's a density within this low-rise context of neighborhoods that makes for a very comfortable mix of people economically and often racially. And this is quite unusual. So I was quite enamored of the city. I came down regularly and knew that I had to write a book on how the city recovered and whether it would recover in the way that I have seen so many urban neighborhoods and cities and downtowns recover from the bottom up through local initiatives organically, as opposed to top down from the outside experts, the policy wonks, or even the public officials.
We will definitely talk about all of those things moving forward in the hour. But before we do, why was New Orleans spared the kind of modernization, using air quotes here, that changed the character of so many other U.S. cities, which, as you said, at one point had that kind of mixed-use development and had a lot of dense urbanism and walkability, that sort of thing?
I think there are a million reasons. And you talk to New Orleanians and they all have a different one. I think it's definitely a combination. First of all, in many ways, it's been a very insular city, both good and bad. But insular because New Orleans is unique among American cities. In many ways, it is the northernmost Caribbean city in the United States. Mm-hmm. It is unlike any other because of its culture. And so it stood apart from many of the trends that were happening nationwide. That is not to say that New Orleans escaped demolition and clearance projects. It had its fair share. What it didn't have, it also, part of the insularity is that it's almost like a quote that I wrote about a man that when I wrote about Savannah in my first book, The Living City, Thinking Small in a Big Way, a man named Lee Adler said Savannah escaped urban renewal because Savannians rejected it as a communist plot. It was basically that a lot of these outside ideas were the other, not appropriate locally. So there was a resistance. And then there was a lot of clearance downtown in many different ways, but not one that destroyed the essential grid. And even in the layers of clearance and rebuilding, the grid was essentially protected. And that keeps the city knit together. And many cities now are trying to restore what they lost, both in the grid as well as in transit. And I know Dallas is among them. So this is what New Orleans never lost, and it's very urban. It is the model.
Now that we know what happened because of Hurricane Katrina, it's easy to accidentally remember it, incorrectly remember it, as an incredibly powerful hurricane. In fact, Katrina was not among the most powerful storms recorded. Why was the damage then so severe, and what kind of information did authorities have regarding the risk for this before this storm even formed?
Well, I'm glad you recognize this because, as a friend down here says, those are fighting words down here if you call this a natural disaster. This was the largest man-made engineering disaster the country has known because the levees failed in 53 places. And you're right. They knew about it ahead of time. There had been a simulated, I guess you'd call it a project, which showed what could happen if such a hurricane hit the city. It was basically ignored. I would say also that Washington was informed. The president was informed. It was basically ignored. And there were people saying, you know, we really have to pay attention to this. The Times-Picayune ran a whole series of articles. I don't remember whether it was a year before or more, but all of the warnings were there. And, you know, this is one of the great lessons because we have so many warnings no matter what city you're in. It's not necessarily a shoreline. Maybe what we're seeing now with forest fires. We may be seeing things in all different forms. We haven't paid as much attention to the compatibility of what we develop and how we develop, and then what to do to prevent disaster when it strikes.
How do jurisdictional squabbles play into relief and recovery efforts?
I don't think that jurisdictional squabbles played as much as one might think. The primary jurisdictional division was that the road home money that was federal money came through the state and then to the city, was to people in the city, was it went through that pipeline. And in effect, that's where all the mistakes were made, because road home is still the one reason that so many, close to 100,000 people, have still not returned, because the basic inequity started that road home valued your dwelling based on the pre-Katrina property value. So if your property was valued at $70,000 before Katrina and you were in the lower ninth ward, and you may have had the same shotgun, you know, the long, thin, classic New Orleans house, the same shotgun you may have uptown where it didn't flood and where values are higher. That shotgun might have been worth $250,000. So then along comes Road Home, and they value your $70,000. Based on that value, they give you, even if, say, they give you the whole $70,000, that home today to rebuild, or right after Katrina, whether uptown or in the lower ninth ward, would cost $250,000. So if you are of limited means, and you get $70,000, and you have to spend the money before being able to recoup your expense. You have to prove that you've spent the money before you get reimbursed. So you have to have a hefty savings account in order to be able to rebuild. And if you should happen to have a mortgage, the lion's share of your $70,000 is first going to the bank to pay off the mortgage. So what are you left with? Whatever is different. So when, the mayor is out there, I think it's lovely that he's telling all the people out there who aren't home, come home, we want you. And I think that's a message to counteract the impression that the city didn't want as many black people in residence. And it's happened. It's instead of 67% black, the population is now about 59% black. But the point is, don't invite people home who have wanted to come home but haven't had the means. So what resources are you offering them? What kind of grants or loans or tax incentives, the kind of things you give developers to build new, what are you doing for the people who own property and can't come to rebuild on it? And that answer is not yet shown to be anything. So that's the one multi-layered governmental program that showed the most inequity. Others were, a lot of the contracts got let by basically out of Washington through political connections to the Bush administration.
Let me jump in, Roberta. We have to take a quick break. I want to make sure we have time to finish this thought. We're speaking about how the people of New Orleans rebuilt their city with urbanist and author Roberta Brandes Gratz. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with urbanist and author Roberta Brandes Gratz. Her new book is called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. You can be part of the conversation at 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Roberta, you were saying some of the reconstruction contracts, many of them, were sort of filtered through the federal government, and high-ranking connections were helpful to those who actually wanted to earn those contracts.
Yes. What I did was I took reports from all newspapers everywhere, from Washington Post, Miami Herald, Times Picayune, and I put together all the outrageous stories of these very big contracts given to politically well-connected corporations that maybe never even had anything to do with the subject they were given a contract for. For example, the debris remover didn't even have a dump truck. And what happened was that all of these contracts were subcontracted three, sometimes four times before getting to the minuscule amount of the money that went to the guy on the ground to actually do the work. My favorite example is the blue tarp, which we saw on the rooftops of all the injured houses to keep the rain out. It's $175 a square. Three subcontracts later, the guy on the ground got $7 a square to put up that blue tarp. Now, every contract that I found was the same kind of process. So I maintain, and nobody can really challenge this because nobody's done a study of it, and certainly Congress hasn't held a hearing or an investigation, but I'm saying that the billions spent on the recovery, take out the $14 billion actually spent on repairing the levees, take out the 1.1 and still counting billion spent on the hospital that wasn't necessary to be built. And what you have left, I would venture to say maybe 20% of it hit the ground in New Orleans. A lot of those contracts went to corporations out of state and certainly out of New Orleans. So it was a disaster capitalism example in its purest form. And even some of the small guys on the ground who got the final contract, some of them suffered because they had to wait so long to get paid. They went bankrupt and went out of business. So on every level, there are so many inequities in this story that it really boggles the mind.
You mentioned a hospital that wasn't necessary. You write here about the sad story of Charity Hospital, which had been a really important institution within the community. What was its history and what happened to it?
Charity Hospital was one of two of the most highly regarded public hospitals in the country. It was almost as old as the city itself, and the latest incarnation was dated from the Huey Long days in the 1930s, an extraordinary Art Deco masterpiece of about 1 million square feet. So the basement flooded during Katrina, but an extraordinary team of military personnel, doctors, nurses, citizens, everybody got together. They cleaned out the hospital like it had never been cleaned in probably since it was built. It was medical ready 3 weeks after the storm. When the head of the hospital, the LSU was the management arm of the hospital, was asked, why don't you just open it temporarily? He said, then we will never get our new hospital. They had wanted a new hospital, but politically they could find no way to get rid of the old hospital. So through a very complicated process, which I detail with every outrage detail in the book, they eventually got FEMA's damage estimate up to $475 million, which was the down payment for the new hospital. The old charity sits there to this day. They're now entertaining development proposals, what to do with it. But what we have instead now is a sprawling suburban campus medical facility with less service than the old charity had, less beds, no obstetrics, no pediatrics. And on the other side of the highway, so a distance from downtown, and with it came the Veterans Administration got a new hospital they didn't need. And in the process, a classically rebounding, economically and racially integrated working class community was demolished. Many of the homes had been restored with government grants and then demolished through eminent domain. It was one of the earliest neighborhoods to be rebounding with people, an incredible network of people working together. So you had 250 houses about and 50 businesses that were destroyed unnecessarily because they could have moved back into the old hospital, and there was an alternative plan that would have upgraded charity in half the time for half the money and upgraded it into a state-of-the-art new hospital. It's an outrage, but it's a lesson and almost a cautionary tale for every city, because these kind of overblown, expensive, unnecessary projects are not uncommon in many cities. It's just that in this case, the hurricane gave them an excuse to do what they couldn't have done politically otherwise.
So many residents of New Orleans, Roberta, realized there was little to be gained in waiting for official recovery efforts to find their way to them. They realized that there were these big dollar projects that didn't necessarily, you know, drill down to their street, their block. People began taking matters into their own hands very early on. Tell us about some of the grassroots projects that really stood out to you.
Well, first, a lot of people just did their own thing. And this is, I like to say that, you know, as bad as former Mayor Ray Nagin was, and now he's in jail, the good news after Katrina was that in some ways what he didn't do was great, because the experts were suggesting a moratorium on building, the moratorium on permits to rebuild. So all the people who were doing their own thing would not have been allowed to do what they did. So individually and collectively, families rebuilt their houses, each, you know, working on each other's houses, local organizations. There in the lower Ninth Ward, there are, oh God, oh, I can't tell you, I've lost count, probably 24 different organizations helping individuals. Around town, there were organizations almost in every neighborhood, not-for-profit organizations who were helping people not only rebuild their house, but get through the bureaucratic nightmare that was road home or insurance or whatever. People who just didn't know how to navigate the system. And then you had a couple of small developers. There's a wonderful preservation developer who rebuilds historic housing for low-income, permanent low-income housing. You had the Len Riggio Project Home Again project, which built very compatible homes in primarily in the Gentilly neighborhood, over 200 of them, for people who would turn in their damaged property and in exchange get this new home. You had the Brad Pitt Make It Right project, which I also go into in detail in the book, because it's a model of how to work with, really work with the community, not just give lip service working through with the community. Here is a community that an unheard of for low-income people to be given a choice of the design of the house. 13 options. And you go in there now, and there are a lot of people, particularly architects, hate the new designs. But the people who are in them love them. And the area really looks like a neighborhood. And the houses are not all alike. It doesn't look like a project. It looks like a neighborhood. And you had a lot of these organizations throughout the city that were working with people in their neighborhood. Churches were and synagogues. They were wonderful. And outsiders, people from all across America, I have to say, and this is a shout out to all of you who came and did what you had to do to help. It was heartwarming to see how many people came from all corners of the country. It's the real barn-raising instinct that is at the core of the American people, and it's beautiful to see, and it was very much a significant help in the rebuilding of the city. And they came on their own dime and at their own expense and often spent money to help instead of just, coming in any kind of paid fashion.
Some people have struggled, people from outside the city, to understand why residents of what had been substandard housing were so devastated by its loss. And you, I think, do a really good job here of explaining that there were communities that, you know, were formed in these places. You know, people had real relationships with their neighbors. It was more than just the building they lived in.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's something to be understood in both about the public housing and the schools that is common in every city, I am sure. We have to understand that with integration, with school integration in the 1960s, came an acceleration of white flight. What happened to public housing when it in New Orleans and other cities, when it turned into a primarily black population, maintenance was cut, the social services were cut, the educational supplemental services were cut. So by the time, and the four key projects in New Orleans, public housing projects, were beautiful red brick tile roofs, wrought iron railings. They were built in the early 1940s when construction in this country was really solid. It is not, has not been since World War II as solid as it was then. So amidst the conditions that they lived in, they established networks. Some of them were family networks, some of them social. So if someone had a job and had to leave their child with a neighbor or a grandmother or an elderly friend, there were these kind of interdependencies that are key in the lives of low-income people. When you disperse that community, you are breaking up all those networks. Only 9%, a recent story indicated, of the original tenants of the demolished projects are rehoused in the new economically integrated projects, and the rest have either been given Section 8 vouchers and told to, you know, find a place in a so-called better neighborhood, which is a lie. And then there are those who haven't been able to come home because they've stopped giving out vouchers and they can't afford the rents that have doubled in this city since Katrina. So you've got a really sad inequity here. And the bottom line is those projects were totally redeemable. They could have been adjusted. Streets could have been put back. A couple of buildings could have come down. But what's key is their location is very close to downtown, valuable property. They were turned over to private developers. And what I'm hearing in the last couple of days is really making me even more angry, is because the Section 8 voucher holders are finding that they have to move farther and farther away from the center and from their jobs. So they are commuting well over an hour to get to their jobs because the transit system in this city is very poor and On some areas, 35% of the bus service is all that is back. So the transit is worse. It's more car dependent. A lot of people don't have cars, and they're worse off than they were before, even if they got home.
Not restoring public transit would seem to be a deliberate way to keep displaced lower-income folks from returning. They literally can't go back because they can't get around.
That's sadly true. And part of the problem specifically here is that the transit agency was contracted out right after Katrina to a private administrating agency whose focus, I'm sure, with, you know, public elected officials' agreement, focused much more on providing transit new streetcars for the tourist population, not for the residential population. So you have a city that once had a very well-connected streetcar system and even a pretty robust bus service system before Katrina, has not come back. In fact, it's worse than it was before Katrina, and some people have been moved further away from their jobs. So you've got a double problem for people like that.
Does tourism, is the city too much invested in the tourist portion of its economy?
Absolutely. All that seems to be on any of the hierarchy's minds is more hotels, more freedom for music venues, even in neighborhoods. They're pulling back some of the kind of regulations, like making sure the doors are closed so that the noise doesn't carry into a neighborhood. It's a real problem, and the prices have gone sky high.
My guest is urbanist and author Roberta Brandes Gratz. Her new book is called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
We have fed over 150,000 people as of last night.
But I guess the point is, as of last night, sir, forgive me, I have to stop you here.
We're hearing people's frustration. There are people that are beginning to manifest themselves out of the community that we didn't know that were there.
Why are you discovering this now? It's 5 days that FEMA's been on the ground. The mayor, the former mayor, putting out SOSs on Tuesday morning, crying on national television, saying, please send in some troops.
There's going to be plenty of opportunities to help later on. But right now, the immediate concern is to save lives and get food and medicine to people so we can stabilize the situation. Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Little sound from the days immediately following Hurricane Katrina. We're speaking this hour with urbanist and author Roberta Brandes Gratz. Her new book is called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Join us at 800-933-5372. One detail that stuck with me for years, Roberta, is the fact that while government agencies were still trying to coordinate, in some cases there were private companies. Walmart was one, sort of well-positioned to make their way into these devastated areas, distribute food and potable water. And it seems to me that there is that's a sort of metaphor for individuals getting the work done that needed to be done in their neighborhoods when large programs were failing to really coordinate these efforts.
Well, the irony and the tragedy is that everyone from Walmart on down to the individual, they were turned away. Because Brownie, that little congratulations will probably live in infamy, as they say, because it's so classic in what it represents. They were turned away because Brownie wanted everything to go through a process. So you had to sign up in order to be able to help. And what that really meant is the help was coming from through contracts, not through volunteers. And, you know, while the government couldn't get its act together, or the federal government, because I think the first meeting, as I recall, in the White House was on the Wednesday after the Saturday of the hurricane, heroes from the state Fish and Wildlife Department, from the Coast Guard, from just neighboring parishes, from the fishermen, they all just got in their boats and went and helped. Thousands of people were rescued just by ordinary American, you know, neighbors, so to speak. And it was beautiful to see, and you can see some of it in the old footage, young and old, strangers, black, white, it didn't matter. People were just reaching out and helping. So if all these people managed to get in, why was it so hard for FEMA? Why was the Red Cross, they were afraid to come in because of all these false stories about shooting and raping and all these totally false stories. But all those individual people, they weren't afraid. If they were afraid, they just put it behind them and they did their job. So here again, it was the individual acts of mercy and help. And the organizing on the top was a total failure. So it just supports the whole theme of the book. If you look at every area, the bad and the good, the contrast between how things function from the top down and from the bottom up. And I don't want to hear anybody tell me, yeah, well, if you leave it to government, it will fail. We have to remember, in many ways, there is no such thing as government left. It's all about contracts. It's the private contractors and all the people in Washington that want to cut the cost of government. I want to know, will they cut the cost of the over-rich contracts for work that government used to do for less money? They don't do it better, and they certainly don't do it cheaper. But on the ground, local organizations, they're not necessarily politically connected. They just know their community. They represent local wisdom. And that's where the real substance and the good work happens. Unfortunately, that's not the way the system works, because the political connections are the most critical to whatever question you want to pose.
New Orleans public schools had notoriously struggled over the decades, and I think there were a lot of urban school districts that sort of eyed this experiment in New Orleans with some interest. Like, what would happen if you could start over from scratch? Tell us a little bit about how the decision was made to convert the public school system to a system of charter schools, and why it's been so hard to know how things have turned out since.
Well, it's very complicated, but this was one of those, you know, disaster opportunities, as they call them. At the state level, there was a recovery school district that had a limited mandate to take over failing schools in New Orleans. Suddenly, that mandate was reconfigured. So the schools that did not open after Katrina, the public schools that did not open after Katrina, by January, when schools started to open, suddenly the recovery school district was in charge and giving out charters to a whole network of charter schools. The reality is the system before Katrina was terrible. And as I made reference earlier, after in the 60s, when budgets were cut and maintenance neglected and teacher's salary was poor and supplies were non-existent, including toilet paper in some schools, the schools had no no possibility of being anything but failing. So they could only get better. Now, you've got now an assortment of mostly charter schools, many of which are excellent, some of which are not. They open, they close if they fail. It's a very mixed system, hard to judge on an overall level. Sure, anything is better on some level than what was, but a lot of the things that made the soul of the city reflected in the schools and their attachment to neighborhood and neighborhood bands and the teachers that knew the children and knew the family, all those connections were disrupted at a very traumatic time in the lives of these people. You know, kids who were 8 years old at the time of Katrina, as I like to say, sadly, they're 18 now and they're killing each other. This was a traumatized youth population that that's where you can see the seeds for today's intractable crime problem. Goes right back to Katrina. And at the same time, the charity hospital not reopening with its mental health wards. There's no mental health facilities in the city. The jail is the mental health answer. I mean, this is ridiculous. How can you even consider, combating crime and helping young people now in their teens be properly educated? A lot of them are falling through the cracks because they've never recovered from the Katrina trauma.
How are residents of New Orleans deciding almost project by project about what kind of redevelopment to allow, in what cases structure should be raised and new things should be put in their place, and when things should be preserved?
Well, this is an interesting point because right after Katrina, something happened in New Orleans that had never happened before. The public got really engaged and involved, and they got involved in a very detailed master plan process in which all the neighborhoods had an opportunity to put input on how the city should be redeveloped. And it was quite a marvel of a process. And then along comes a rezoning, the comprehensive zoning ordinance. And suddenly, so many of the things that were democratically decided on through this public process are being taken away. And the city council is back to a lot of backroom deals. It's questionable what's happening at the Planning Commission. One can see which developers are helping reshape the zoning. It's the jury is now out. And in the conclusion of my book, I point to a story that I won't repeat here to show the backsliding. And I say at the end of the book that after 10 years, there is a question as to whether or not so much of the advance that was accomplished after Katrina, particularly in the public process and the engagement through neighborhoods and all of that very newly democratic process, it's beginning to be eroded. So I don't know where it's going to go on how the city is being reshaped. Suddenly there are proposals to build things in neighborhoods way out of scale and out of context in the neighborhood. And there are several fights going on and will continue because there's a real question as to whether what was decided for the master plan will be honored after the 10 years.
What is life like in the Lower Ninth Ward today?
The Lower Ninth Ward, if you go in today for the first time, you will say, what are they talking about? This is hopeless. It's a vast, a lot of it is empty. There are clusters of houses here and there and a couple of large segments, but a lot of emptiness. But I just have to tell you, the one quote from the woman, elderly woman that I interviewed early on, she was one of the first people to rebuild her house, have it rebuilt. And I said, Mrs. Butler, aren't you worried about coming back to a place so empty? And she leaned forward and she said to me, honey, when we came in 1948, there was nobody. There were oyster shell pathways. It was 45 minutes a walk to church, to the bus. But you know what? They will come. They came then, and they will come. And they, all I can say is, it may not look like it, but they are coming. Houses are being built. And if the city were really interested in seeing people come back, they would put out loans to the people who don't have enough money to rebuild and help people rebuild, because a lot of them are in the lower Ninth Ward. And it is slowly but surely coming back, and the city is finally providing some rebuilt institutions, a new school, a new community center, a new firehouse 10 years later, a new restaurant opened, a new grocery store opened, a CVS is coming. It's slow, and it's going to be the slowest neighborhood in the city to return. It was the most devastated, but they will come.
Is there a lesson that the rest of the country, cities elsewhere that might be susceptible to other kinds of large-scale disasters, might take from New Orleans?
I think there are lessons in the entire story of the rebirth of New Orleans, particularly on what to watch for in terms of the disaster opportunity or the disaster capitalism and the organizing and how to help neighborhoods. I quote a couple of local people in the book and the kind of things that would have helped them do the on-the-ground work better. If you recognize that the best work is done on the ground by the people in the communities, led and aided and abetted by others, helping them do what they know is right, if that's the attitude, then the positive change will occur. If the experts are coming in and saying what should happen and what shouldn't happen, then you're going to have a lot of angry resistance, and they're wrong. They have invariably wrong.
And you're still living there part of the year, every year.
I am indeed. I've moved, but I'm in a different neighborhood, but I'm not giving up New Orleans. It's not giving up me. I have the best of both worlds. I avoid snow in the winter from New York. I come in December and I stay till May. And then I go home for the very hot season, and I leave the heat and hurricanes normally to them. But I'm down here for a couple of weeks, it's not as unbearable as I thought.
The new book by urbanist Roberta Brandes Gratz is called We're Still Here, You Bastards, How the People of New Orleans Rebuilt Their City. Roberta, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. You've been a wonderful questioner.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help on the phones today from Lauren Aguirre. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.